Hello, everyone. My name is Dr. Bill Parker, and I'm the Chief Operating Officer of the East West Institute here in New York City. Welcome to another episode of the EWI Podcast, a platform where we explore some of today's key global issues with leading thinkers and analysts. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming eminent China scholar, Dr. Elizabeth Economy. Dr. Economy, welcome to the EWI Podcast.
Thanks so much, Bill. It's great to be here.
Dr. Economy is the C.V. Starr Senior Fellow and Director for Asia Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations and a distinguished visiting fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institute. She is an acclaimed author and expert on Chinese domestic and foreign policy, writing on topics ranging from China's environmental challenges to its roles in global governance. In June of this year, Dr. Economy was named one of the 10 names that matter on China policy by Politico magazine. Today, I want to take the opportunity to discuss your third and latest book titled The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. So, let's jump right into it. Why do you see China approaching what you call the Third Revolution under President Xi Jinping's leadership? What makes it distinct from movements in the past?
So, I think if you look back just to Xi Jinping's speech in October of 2017, when he was reselected as General Secretary of the Communist Party, you know, for his second five-year term, he delivered a three-and-a-half-hour speech. And in that speech, he uttered one statement, China has stood up, grown rich, become strong, and is moving toward center stage. And I think that statement, better than anything else I've found, encapsulates sort of the three revolutions and the evolution of China as a contemporary political state. So if you take the China has stood up, that really refers to Mao Zedong, and Mao Zedong standing up against the Japanese invaders and standing up against the ruling party of the time in China, the Kuomintang, and creating the contemporary Chinese party state in 1949. The second revolution was ushered in by Deng Xiaoping in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And Deng, in fact, called his period the Second Revolution. And that was a period in which China introduced the market into the economy. He moved the leadership system from an individual system of leadership to a collective leadership. He brought in ideas and capital from outside China in order to spur economic development. He welcomed those outside ideas and foreign capital. He maintained a low-profile foreign policy because he wanted to focus on development within China, on raising the standard of living for the Chinese people. And it was really the first time as well that you had civil society blossom in China and the establishment of non-governmental organizations. So it was a period of reform and opening up, and it was the time, as she said, that China became rich. And then if you move to 2012 and the selection of Xi Jinping as the General Secretary of the Communist Party and then in 2013 as President of the country, we find that he has in many respects upended Deng Xiaoping's Second Revolution. So many of the norms and approaches to governing that Deng instituted, she has really reversed them. He has moved from a collective leadership back to a far more single-person authoritarian form of leadership. He has amassed an enormous amount of institutional power in his own hands. He has reasserted the role of the Communist Party into Chinese society and into the economy. One of the hallmarks of the Deng era was the withdrawal of the party from everyday life. You know, Deng was someone who very much wanted market principles to take hold, both in terms of an economic market, but also in terms of a marketplace of ideas. She has also acted to construct what I call a virtual wall of restrictions and regulations to control what comes into the country. So he is less interested than Deng Xiaoping was in welcoming competition from multinationals. For example, China's Made in China 2025 program is very much designed to keep out foreign competition in 10 areas of critical cutting-edge technology. They passed a law in, or implemented the law really, in January of 2017, designed to limit the access of foreign non-governmental organizations in China. So before January of 2017, there were some you know, more than 7,000 foreign NGOs who are working in China, helping to work on poverty issues or health issues or environmental challenges, working with their Chinese counterparts to try to address these problems. After the law was passed and control over foreign NGOs moved from the Ministry of Civil Society to the Ministry of Public Security, which I think gives you a very good idea for how they were looking at these foreign NGOs as a potential security threat, the number of those NGOs, those foreign NGOs operating in China, dropped to about 300 to 400. So from more than 7,000 to 300 to 400. And then finally, and I think most evident to anybody here in the United States, Xi Jinping has rejected Deng Xiaoping's sort of mantra of a low-profile foreign policy and has pursued a much more expansive and ambitious role for China on the global stage.
So, Dr. Economy, there's a debate going on right now whether Xi's public statements are focused on and designed for internal or external audiences or both. And I was wondering if you could touch upon that for a moment.
Well, I think, Xi Jinping very much is speaking to both audiences. I think if we're looking at something like what's going on right now with the trade war, it's clear that he is trying to reassure the people at home that the trade war will not have much impact on the Chinese economy over the long haul. Former People's Bank official came out and said that, at most, the Chinese economy will drop by about a half of a percentage point over the long term if this trade war is prolonged. But at the same time, the Chinese people can look and can see that the stock market has fallen to its lowest point since 2014. The exports are falling, have fallen consecutively for 5 months now, and that Chinese companies are shedding more jobs than they are increasing. So they can see the signs that the trade war is in fact having a negative impact, and yet Xi Jinping has to be out there trying to reassure them that the Chinese economy is stable, that he has everything well in hand, and not to worry, because the last thing that he wants is a panic situation. At the same time, he's speaking to U.S. President Trump and telling him that we are not going to back down. We are not going to transform our economic system in order to accommodate your interests. China is strong, and we will push back, and we, in fact, will triumph over the long haul. So I think on most issues now, there's a fusion of the domestic and the international, whether you're talking about the economy or technology or certainly political, the Belt and Road Initiative, all of these things, I think, represent both, Chinese domestic public interest as well as interest in the international community.
So you state that the ultimate objective of Xi's revolution is his Chinese dream, the rejuvenation of the great Chinese nation. What is the vision behind this new Chinese dream? What does this entail for the global community?
So I think if you were to look in practical terms, what does the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation mean? I think it has several meanings for Xi Jinping. So I think it means that you have a robust Chinese Communist Party that's at the forefront of the Chinese political system. One of probably the most important policy initiatives that Xi Jinping undertook when he first came into office was his anti-corruption campaign. When he first started as General Secretary of the Communist Party, he said if corruption in the Chinese Communist Party were not addressed, that it could mean the death of the party and the death of the Chinese state. So one of the things that we've seen over the past 6 years has been that every year since he's been in office, more Chinese officials, more Chinese Communist Party officials have been arrested than the previous year. I think last year, upwards of 500,000 party officials were detained or arrested. So I think, the first thing and the priority for Xi Jinping is really to have this Communist Party be strong and central in terms of its leadership role for the country. The second is, a robust Chinese economy, but really the transformation of China from a manufacturing center in the world to an innovation center. And here we see that Xi has poured money into research and development, has set ambitious targets and timetables for Chinese companies to try to capture both domestic markets as well as to become global champions. That's really what the Made in China 2025 program is all about. looking at sectors like artificial intelligence and new materials and new energy vehicles, medical devices, and saying, we want Chinese companies to be the dominant force controlling Chinese market by 2025, and also to be on par with, you know, multinationals in the global competition. And the way that they're going about doing this in many respects is by putting up market barriers to entry for companies. For example, in Sichuan province recently, I saw that local officials had told all the hospitals that they could no longer buy medical devices that were produced outside of China, that were manufactured by multinationals. They had to purchase a Chinese company medical devices, things like stents and respirators. No matter if they were inferior products, no matter even if they were more expensive, they want to give Chinese companies a chance to capture the market, to grow, to improve, and then to become global champions. And they believe that if they allow multinationals to continue to dominate, the Chinese companies won't, in fact, be able to compete. So the second thing is, by hook or by crook, really, to transform China into a global innovation center. Third, I think, is really the idea of reclaiming a degree of Chinese centrality on the global stage. And here I would point to sort of three different elements of Xi's approach. You know, first is to move from staking claims of Chinese sovereignty to realizing them. And by that I mean, if you look at the South China Sea, Taiwan and Hong Kong, these are areas that China, mainland China, claims as sovereign territory. And we've seen, you know, over the past 5 to 6 years that China has moved very aggressively to, you know, create and then militarize 7 artificial features in the South China Sea to establish a, you know, sort of Chinese beachhead in effect. So I think, you know, one element of that is just the militarization that has taken place. The second is sort of economic, a mix of economically coercive policies as well as inducements for Taiwan, right, to try to encourage Taiwan to bind itself to the mainland. And, you know, thus far, Taiwan has not displayed much interest in binding itself to mainland China. And so, you know, by doing things like reducing the tourists or by buying off Taiwan's diplomatic allies or forcing multinationals not to recognize Taiwan as a separate entity on their websites, all these different small but painful measures, China's hoping to force Taiwan into some form of unification. The second element of Xi's sort of reclamation of centrality on the global stage, I think, is evidenced by China's Belt and Road Initiative, which is, of course, the grand-scale initiative to connect China to, you know, 68 countries, now really it's the whole world, through both physical infrastructure like railroads and highways and ports and pipelines, as well as digital infrastructure, so satellites and e-commerce and fiber optic cables. So basically establishing sort of a central role for China, you know, that emulates the old Silk Road and the maritime spice routes, the recreation of a period of time when China was really at the center of the global economy. So that's a second important initiative of Xi Jinping. And the third, I would say, is an effort by Xi to reform institutions and norms related to global governance. So one of the things that Xi has made very clear in many speeches over the past few years is that he wants institutions like the United Nations or, you know, new agreements on things like internet sovereignty to reflect Chinese values, not simply to reflect the values of the United States and other market democracies. So we see a pretty concerted effort by China at this point in time to try to reform these institutions, to insert Chinese values, Chinese ideas into the discourse and into the way that the new rules and institutions will be structured and the types of policies that they'll adopt. So I think, you know, over the long haul, that has the potential to be as transformative a move as anything else that Xi is doing.
So you mentioned Belt and Road Initiative. You refer at least to the Asian Infrastructure Bank. You talk about corruption. Do you think beyond economic influence that the positive momentum to build an economic community in Asia is undermined by the aggressive military actions as seen by many, such as their operations in the South China Sea?
I think that certainly the goodwill that China generates when it goes out and structures these enormous infrastructure projects throughout the rest of Asia and the Middle East, Europe and Africa, I think the goodwill that it generates by DoNet is undermined by a couple of things, at least in part. First, by the fact that China often doesn't undertake these projects with the best governance, right? So many of the deals are not transparent. The United States and now many other countries are calling out China for what they call debt diplomacy, right? So we see in at least 8 countries in which Belt and Road projects have been undertaken that the levels of debt have risen so high that these countries will likely never be able to repay them. And thus we see China, for example, you know, taking control of a port in Sri to enable Sri Lanka to pay off some of its debt by simply granting China a 99-year concession. So I think that tends to make local populations very unhappy when they see these kinds of deals being struck. And so we see now that a number of countries from Pakistan to Malaysia, Nepal, many countries now are sort of taking a step back from a number of the projects that were on the books and saying either we don't want to do them or we want more time to evaluate the implications for, you know, our financial health. You know, similarly, the environmental implications of many of China's projects, though China is offloading a lot of its polluting industry. For example, while China's cutting down on coal use within its own country, it's exporting more than 100 coal-fired power plants through the Belt and Road Initiative. So some countries like Kenya are now getting their first coal-fired power plant ever in an environmentally sensitive area, again, that produced a lot of local protests. So China undermines, I think, a lot of its goodwill by not following best governance practices in doing these deals and undertaking these projects. Also, I think, as you rightly suggest, China's military assertiveness has caused a good deal of consternation, especially in its own backyard. And so I think while some countries further away, like in Africa, or even some in Europe, may not be as concerned about Chinese military assertiveness. Certainly, in its own neighborhood, countries look at this and wonder, you know, what kind of regional power China is becoming and are concerned about it. So I think, yes, that causes them to question China's intentions, and it also causes them to look to the United States to, you know, continue to want the United States to be an important, even dominant presence in the region.
Well, it's interesting because in some ways it seems like Xi's reforms over the past 5 years almost contradict themselves. His domestic policies have become more authoritarian, stricter regulations on the internet, oversight of NGOs and other aspects of civil society. But his foreign policy has arguably become more ambitious. So can you explain that polarization a little bit?
Right. It's one of the main points that I try to make in the book is that on the one hand, he's both more repressive, authoritarian, even insular to some extent at home, while more expansive and ambitious abroad. You know, I don't think that there is some kind of inherent conflict in what he's doing. I mean, he is controlling the people at home, but in some respects, he's also seeking to export those same values and that same system abroad. I mean, one of the surprising things is that, or I should say not that surprising, but many people did not anticipate that he would actually suggest that China could be a good development model, a good political model for other developing countries, that it in fact could compete with Western liberal democracies as a development model. And so you see now Chinese officials in a number of African countries, as well as Southeast Asia, and even some in Latin America, beginning to train local officials on how to manage local populations, right? What can we do in terms of controls over the internet and the media? How do we manage political stability? So this is a very new and different element of Chinese foreign policy, and it's very much a reflection of what Xi Jinping is doing at home.
So one of my favorite quotes in your book, and there is a lot of them, but one particularly says, "We must deal with China as it is today, a country that often confounds us with contradictions." So what approach should U.S. policymakers take to better navigate our relationship with this very interesting China as it contradicts itself?
So, yeah, I mean, obviously, I wrote an entire chapter worth of policy recommendations, but I guess, you know, in brief, I would say, you know, the United States, I think at this point, has moved almost 180 degrees from where it was during the Obama administration in terms of its overall approach to China. I think it recognizes much more profoundly the challenge that China poses to the United States, both in terms of its political and economic interests, but also, you know, in terms of its desire to really transform the geostrategic landscape as well. So I think there's a new awareness now that's quite important that really wasn't there when I was doing the research for the book. And it's one of the things that I pointed out in the recommendation section that I think we needed to think in sort of more, I don't know, tough terms in some respects about China. So, you know, one of the things I advocate is that we should be adopting greater reciprocity, that the United States has usually, you know, historically operated under the belief that if we model best behavior, China will follow, right? If we integrate China into the international system and set a good example for the values of you know, free markets and freedom of navigation and human rights, that China eventually is going to come down this path. Now, I happen to believe that Chinese history is not over, and I hope that this is the direction in which China is going to go. But for now, and this is why that point you raised is so critical, we have to deal with China as it is today. And the way that China is today does not reflect that hope that many Americans, myself included, had about China in 2010, 2011, that in fact was moving toward a more open political system, that it was becoming a more responsible player in the international system. So one of the things I say is that we can't be afraid of reciprocity. So if China is closing off its markets to U.S. companies in certain areas, we should be prepared to do the same to China, that we have to stand up for, you know, our principles, our values, and push back against China in ways that typically we have not wanted to do. Second is that we need to continue working with our allies. I think one of the striking things that I discovered in researching the book was that, you know, on virtually all issues, whether political or economic or security, the United States, Japan, European allies, Australia, you know, most countries, you know, developed countries in the world, we share the same perspective on both the opportunities and the challenges that China presents. If you look at, for example, the U.S.-China Chamber of Commerce reports and the European-China Chamber of Commerce reports and what multinationals are saying about the challenges they face with regard to doing business in China, they say almost the exact same thing, down to maybe a 1 percentage point difference. That's it. So we should be working with our allies in constructive ways, both to engage China, but also to hedge against China and to push back against China. So I think that's one thing that this administration in particular, you know, it needs to give life to its concept of a free and open Indo-Pacific. It needs to put policies in place to realize that program, because it has the right idea, I think, of, you know, advancing the values of democracy, you know, political, economic, and security through partnerships with Australia and India and Japan. So I think that's important, but we're not really necessarily fulfilling the promise of the idea. And the last, of course, is, and, you know, in some respects is the easiest to see and the most difficult to operationalize, and that is simply ensuring that we ourselves here in the United States are the best that we can be. And that means that we continue to support research and development, that we continue to ensure that the United States remains a technological powerhouse, that we invest in our education, that our institutions, our democratic institutions, remain robust. Freedom of the press, the things that have always made America great, have always been what has attracted, been attractive to the rest of the world about the United States, that we don't allow those institutions to erode and deteriorate. I think that's absolutely essential in responding to this China challenge, to the enormity, really, of this China challenge. I'm going to make one last point, and that is, in all of this discouraging news about the direction in which China has moved over the past 5 to 6 years, I think it's also important that we not lose sight of opportunities to cooperate. China doesn't have to be a Cold War type enemy. And I don't, you know, think the dominant theme should be that we are trying to contain China. We should still be searching out opportunities for cooperation. You know, if we wanted to look at things like, you know, development programs, I mean, China's Belt and Road Initiative could be so much better than it is, and the United States should be stepping up to compete with it, but also to partner with it. So I think there are areas where we can continue to cooperate, and we don't want to lose sight of that. We don't want the foundations and the pillars of this relationship to erode so deeply that we do end up in a real Cold War.
So that's a great segue to our last minute or so of the show here. You have talked about don't look over your shoulders at the past, but deal with China as it is today. My last question for you is, in a minute or so, can you touch upon what does China look like in this world 10 and 20 years down the road? And I know that could be three more books for you, but just very shortly, where do you think China goes in the next decade?
I mean, I think there's likely to be a reaction back against the very repressive nature of the Xi regime. I think if you look at what's going on today in China, you see that, yes, Xi has amassed an enormous amount of institutional support, but there are also very deep pockets of discontent in Chinese society. You know, everything from liberal intellectuals to private entrepreneurs to retired party elders, you know, pensioners, retired People's Liberation Army officials, you know, the feminist movement, the LGBTQ movement, the environmental movement. There are many elements of Chinese society that are not happy with the direction in which Xi Jinping has moved the country and the power he has amassed in his own hands. So I would anticipate that, you know, in the next five-year cycle, in 2022, you know, we will see some pushback between now and then, and certainly after that point, against this very repressive authoritarian regime that Xi Jinping has constructed.
Dr. Economy, before we close the show, I'd like to thank you again for joining us today from the Council on Foreign Relations and sharing your insights on the transformative changes underway in today's China. Again, I encourage all our guests to read her new book, The Third Revolution, Xi Jinping and the New Chinese State. Again, Dr. Economy, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks again, Bill.
Remember to look for EWI Podcast on our website, SoundCloud, and iTunes under the name of East West Institute, where you can listen, follow, and subscribe so you won't miss our conversations. Thank you for listening.